Welcome to Stuff from the Science Lab from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey guys, welcome to the podcast. This is Allison Loudermilk, science editor at HowStuffWorks.com.
And this is Robert Lamb, science writer at HowStuffWorks.com.
So, Robert, I'm going to take you back a few summers.
Hit me with it.
It was sunny. I was at my sister-in-law's. We were in the pool. It was a fine pool. It was a fine summer day. I was enjoying myself thoroughly. And on that day, I had a very unique experience. I was swimming with my nephews, and all of a sudden, I smelled this odor. Woo! It was a strong odor. And it was emanating from my mischievous, giggling little nephew.
Oh.
And I didn't know what the odor was. I'd never smelled it before. I'd never smelled this odor before, but good Lord, was it bad. And all of a sudden, I got a little excited because I think what I was smelling for the very first time that day was asparagus pea.
In your ool, of all places.
Well, not mine, my sister-in-law,
yeah,
thank goodness. But yeah, and this was exciting to me because I'd always heard about asparagus pea, and some of us maybe who can smell it, or some of us who can't smell it. And I thought that maybe for the first time I had this experience where I could smell asparagus pea.
Right, and for those of you out there who don't know what we're talking about, the scientific literature refers to it as, quote, an odor compared to that of rotten boiled cabbage.
And it did indeed smell like rotten boiled cabbage. It was powerful. It was distinct.
I tend to think of it smelling kind of like a robot pee or something. I don't know.
The reason I was so excited by this was because I thought that I couldn't smell it.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been told that there are certain people who can smell said asparagus pea, and so this was the very first time. But as it turns out, there's this whole scientific school of thought on, you know, asparagus pea, whether they're, and it's split into two camps, right?
Right. On one hand, you have the people, the scientists who support the idea of excretors and non-excretors. According to this line of thinking, you have people like me, an excretor, whose urine smells like, smells funny following the consumption of asparagus. And then we have people like you, a non-excretor.
Right. I would have been a non-excretor. So this was my first encounter with an excretor.
Right. But then there are also people who claim that it's not really an issue of whether or not your urine smells funny after asparagus. They argue that everybody's urine smells funny following asparagus consumption.
It's just that some of us can sniff it out,
right.
Others
some
can't.
Some people can smell it and some people can't. Your story, however, tends to point more in the direction of the excretor, non-excretor argument.
So this is one of those examples where I'm a little befuddled by the fact that this takes up space on our genes.
Yeah, this is definitely one of those where you read any kind of scientific mention of it, and you think there are definitely people out there going, hey, is my tax money going to support some scientist smelling a bunch of asparagus pea? You know, and it's not really like that, per se. Though I think some people may be being
And in fact, they have been messing around with it since, what, 1735 or so?
That's the earliest written documentation of asparagus pea. They may have, you know, smelled it before that. There may have been instances like your experience with, you know, like ancient Roman baths suddenly reeking of boiled cabbage.
Oh, that's a terrible, terrible thought.
But 1735 was the first time people started talking about it. In 1956 is when the excretor, non-excretor argument came about.
And do they know what the genetic mechanism is at work?
Yes, it is MIM, that stands for missing in metastasis, 108-390.
But they're still split on the excretor versus
according
olfactory.
To the American Journal of Human Genetics, it's still kind of up in the air. But we know that more or less the genetic address that this issue is stemming from.
So that's definitely one of the stranger genetic markers.
Yeah, what we're talking about here is genetic polymorphism, which is the fancy way of saying my genes are different than your genes.
Sure, yeah. So asparagus is one of those examples where it's not entirely straightforward. You may have a marker, but you may not have that particular behavior or ability expressed. But sometimes things are more straightforward, and they call them Mendelian traits. After Gregor Mendel, the guy who came up with those 2x2 boxes in which you had to put in, you know, eye color and figure out what the dominant or recessive gene was,
mm-hmm.
right? So
yes.
You have things like whether you're an albino or not, you know, are these very are these very straightforward examples where a single gene controls the expression.
Right.
So albinos, and whether or not you have a cleft chin, whether you have dimples, and then you have some fun ones. And one of these that I'd never come across before was whether or not you have hair on your mid-digit. And this is a...
Yeah, this is a pretty cool one. If you look at your fingers right now, unless you're driving, look at your fingers, you'll notice that each finger is basically can be divided into three sections.
Right.
It's that middle section. You might take a look at that and see if there's any hair on it. If you have hair on it, then yes, you have...
mid-digit finger hair.
Exactly. And if you don't, then I guess you have mid-digit finger baldness. I have the mid-digit finger baldness, I have to admit.
See, I think that maybe you're not looking hard enough, because I actually do have a little tiny...
Or that I'm secretly shaving them out of shame every morning so that nobody notices.
I have like a little mid-digit mohawk. But I also read something that said some people's hair there, it gets worn off by toil. And stuff like housework, or you know, if you're working with your hands a lot, that maybe you do have that gene, maybe you do have that phenotype. But
this seems like a great, great opening for some sort of weird Victorian fad, you know, where you have like fake hair on your mid knuckle to show how little you have to work. But maybe that's just me.
Right, you have like hairy middle fingers or hairy mid digit.
Right, you put
and
those on
alabaster skin.
Yeah, and then you put your fake mole on, and you're good to go.
And then, so carrying this on a little bit, another Mendelian trait that's very straightforward is the bitter taste perception. And you guys have probably heard of this with respect to super tasters. So this just basically measures...
And this is different than just mere food snobbery, where someone has a lot of cool lingo they throw around and pretend to appreciate the food on levels that the average person cannot even aspire to. These people supposedly are actually experiencing... different tastes and
a higher sensitivity to certain tastes. Although they're pretty rare folks. But generally, sometimes they're just testing whether you can taste PTC or PROP, and these are these bitter tastes. And they kind of accidentally came across this discovery. And you might say, why are we occupying time and money on this thing? Well, you know, it does have some ramifications for things like nutrition and health. I mean, if your taste buds are a certain way, then you'll be inclined to eat certain foods, and that has ramifications for your nutrition and your overall health, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. And even some of these that sound, you know, kind of pointless, it's important to realize that, you know, we were continuing to learn more about who we are. We've mapped the human genome, you know, and it's kind of like mapping a city. You know, there are certain parts of a city you need to know where they are. You know, you need to know where the hospital is. You need to know where the courthouse is.
Right. So the hospital, the courthouse in this instance might be like the BRCA1 or BRCA2, the breast cancer genes that they've
right.
done so much work
on. Yeah, those are the ones that, you know, we really want to be able to know, you know, what we're doing with those particular genes. However, any complete map is also going to have other things on there, like the local Taco Bell or, you know, or the yacht club, you know, places that you either have no interest, you know, or desire in going to. But it's part of having a complete map. And then there are instances where a seemingly uninteresting or unimportant item on the map can actually clue us into others, such as if for instance, the Taco Bell was also...
the indicator to turn for the hospital.
Right, exactly. Then it would be important to know where the Taco Bell is.
And something that kind of falls in this category is another one of these straightforward traits called earwax.
Yes.
And you probably don't need somebody to test your, do a little genetic testing on you to figure out what kind of earwax you have. You probably know what kind of earwax
you have. Yeah, all you need is a finger or a Q-tip.
So earwax comes in two flavors.
Oh, don't say flavors.
Well, I only say flavors because they describe it as wet and golden reminds me of raisins and... That's why I think of that. And then there's also the dry and flaky kind, right? So those are the two kinds of earwax.
It's like gross and grosser are the two different varieties.
And this is what the ABC11 gene is supposedly there for. But the other thing that this gene is implicated in is the production of colostrum, which is an early form of breast milk for nursing moms. So on some level, earwax and breast milk may have some sort of very intricate relationship that we don't know how it works.
Yeah, it's also linked to some body odor issues as well. And it, you know, it's one of those things where earwax, not really an issue. Body odor, sometimes an issue. Breast cancer, definitely an issue. So we've also found some really interesting genetic markers linked to sleep issues. For instance, there's the period 3 genetic marker. which scientists have studied in relation to sleep deprivation.
Okay.
Sleep deprivation, we all know, is generally a bad thing. You know, it's the idea if you don't get enough sleep, you're more susceptible to illness. You might be crankier. You're going to have a harder time at work the next day.
You might crash on the highway on your way to work.
Right. You might see phantoms, etc. It can get really bad. You know, ask Keith Richards, I guess. But the issue is some people have a short period 3 gene, and scientists have found that the people with the short version are better able to cope with sleep deprivation.
So like Albert Einstein, who is said to exist on only a few hours of sleep a night.
Yeah, or, you know, the college student who can get a half hour sleep and, you know, 8 Red Bulls later, he's able to, you know, cope perfectly well with his classes. It's, you know, these people are the exception.
So this is the form of the gene, that, or the form of the genetic variant that you would want.
I suppose, yeah. If we've reached the, you know, the point where you can pick and choose what your, you know, genetic settings are going to be, this one would probably be a good one. The people with the longer version of the gene, these are the people that are going to be, you know, be all, if I don't get my 8 hours of sleep, you know, I'm worthless. I've got to have that, you know, 1 p.m. nap or I won't be able to function, that kind of thing.
Do you take a 1 p.m. nap?
It's in my contract. Yeah, every day.
Climbing to your desk like George Costanza.
Yeah, I have a little mat, everything.
What about sleep? Have they found anything with sleepwalking?
Yeah, there's another study dealing with the DQB1 polymorphic amino acid, and they found that this gene is particularly associated with motor control issues during sleep. We're talking about narcolepsy. Sleepwalking.
So these annoying people who kick you in bed? Restless leg syndrome?
Restless leg syndrome is thrown in there. Also those annoying people who howl in their sleep.
I've never heard a howler.
Yeah. Some people are howlers. So
The howling has some sort of genetic background to it, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sure does. But then again, like a lot of the stuff, you could also be howling in your sleep because your job really sucks and you have nightmares about it. You know, that kind of thing.
So a lot of what makes us who we are and how we behave isn't so straightforward, of course, and our genetics are anything but simple and straightforward.
Right, and I think a great example of this is the whole issue of the, quote, gay gene, unquote. And, you know, first and foremost, there is no gay gene. Nobody's saying, like, yes, the such-and-such 376 here, if it's on, you're gay. If it's off, you're straight. If it's in the middle, you're probably bi. You know, nobody's saying that. It's there are probably a number of genetic markers, scientists are saying, but it's like it's a number of different genetic settings, if you will. And they're not the only thing determining, you know, how you turn out. There's also a lot of, you know, it's your upbringing. It's social issues. It's your environment.
It's your parenting.
Right. And that goes beyond you know, issues of sexual orientation and into any number of behavioral and biological results.
The old nature versus nurture debate at its finest, of course. So if you want to learn more about genetics and what can your spit tell you about your DNA, why don't you go on over to howstuffworks.com. We have so much good content around this, most of which Robert wrote. Thanks for listening, guys.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com. Want more HowStuffWorks? Check out our blogs on the HowStuffWorks.com homepage.